Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver, Jonathan Evans, and Anna Mateo. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson have a special report about one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
The United States has more than 4,000 colleges and universities. It is not easy to decide which schools might be best for you. At the end of high school, many young people in the United States apply for admission to several different schools. The College Board is a nonprofit organization working to expand access to higher education in the U.S. It recommends that students apply to between 5 and 8 schools. This gives them options if their first or second choice schools do not accept them. Paul White, an assistant dean of college admissions, agrees. White works at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. He has worked in university admissions for 38 years. White says that he applied to just 3 colleges when he was a high school student in 1974. If he were a student applying today, however, White says he would apply to 4 times as many schools. The reason? The number of students attending college in the U.S. has more than doubled since he was a college student. The schools make it easier for students to apply, White says. And the competition for admission has gotten more intense.
Colleges and universities have become much more public-oriented, going after not just the best students, but students in general, to try to attract students from different parts of the country, different parts of the world.
But White says there are major differences between applying to an undergraduate program and applying to a graduate degree program. Most graduate degree programs are smaller than undergraduate programs. They can only accept a limited number of students. For example, more than 3,000 students applied to admissions to Johns Hopkins Medical Doctorate Program for the 2018 school year. The program accepted only 120 of them. How does the school choose some students over others? White says he feels that many students are concerned about just meeting the requirements to get into the school rather than getting to know the qualities of the program and school. It is easy to see which students have not thought about whether Johns Hopkins is necessarily a good fit for them, he adds. Every school has different goals, White notes. Some are more focused on research than others. Around 95% of new medical students at Johns Hopkins have some research experience. But that is not the only thing Johns Hopkins is looking for, he says. Johns Hopkins is in Baltimore, Maryland. Its location has an effect on its medical program and the students it accepts, White says. In 2016, the Maryland Alliance for the Poor reported that about 45% of Baltimore's population was living in poverty. The hospital where Johns Hopkins medical students get training works to treat health issues connected to poverty. A student interested in studying at the medical school, therefore, should show an interest in helping a poor, underserved community, White explains.
We want people who want to care for patients. There's no question about that. But you have to look at what are they doing, not just on campus, but off campus. And if someone is interested in working with underserved communities, this is a great place for them.
White says applicants should spend time researching what kind of students a school looks for. They can start by visiting the school's website, which will usually describe the programs the school is involved with. The website might also list its students with special achievements. White also suggests finding out what kind of research the school is doing and what former students are doing after graduation. Having experience that is connected to a school's goals is important, he adds. For example, volunteer work can show that a medical school candidate does not just care about their career. The applicant also cares about helping a community. Even if a student does not have volunteer experience when they are applying, White says it is not too late for a student to show the admissions officers what kind of person they are. That can come during the interview process.
Interviews are a big part of the selection process at Johns Hopkins and most other medical schools. Candidates must answer questions about themselves and why they want to attend the school. For example, at Johns Hopkins, interviewers often ask candidates to talk about a time they were not in the majority. Thoughtful answers can help interviewers better understand what kind of a person a candidate is, White says. A student who may not have volunteer experience but gives thoughtful answers can show the interviewers they have an interest in gaining the understanding that such experience brings. That helps demonstrate that, with guidance, this person can become the kind of doctor the school hopes to produce, White says. Although undergraduate and graduate programs differ in many ways, trying to find the right fit can help undergraduate applicants too. If a student knows the kind of school they are looking for and can thoughtfully express why they want to attend, that makes them more appealing.
I don't care what institution you're going to, they're all trying to shape a community. They're trying to attract people who will add to that community.
I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
A new report says the crocodile industry in Australia's Northern Territory is worth more than four times the previous estimate of $80 million. Officials hope the findings will be meaningful to poor Aboriginal communities that might develop a crocodile farming industry. The saltwater crocodile is the world's largest reptile. In Australia, the crocodiles were once hunted until they almost disappeared. Their skins were used to make durable leather goods and clothes. The crocodiles have been a protected species since the early 1970s, and their numbers in Australia's tropical north have increased. the Northern Territory Regional Government now sees economic opportunities for Native communities. Officials want to expand crocodile egg collection programs. The eggs would help to stock crocodile farms owned by Aboriginal groups. These groups would supply skins to companies such as Louis Vuitton and Gucci that make costly clothing and other products. Michael Gunner is the chief minister of the Northern Territory. Gunner says the government is looking into investing in rangers to help grow the crocodile industry. He says harvesting eggs and growing the crocodile industry locally is a very important and valuable use of traditional country done by traditional owners. Bob Catter is a member of the Australian Parliament. He said that as crocodile numbers increase, so does the threat to people. He believes hunters should be permitted to shoot them for sport. Catter has argued that crocodile hunts would boost the incomes of Aboriginal communities. The Northern Territory government supports crocodile hunts, but only Australia's federal government can make the final decision. So far, they have refused to permit them. Conservationists say that the shooting of animals for profit in Australia is, in their words, abhorrent and should never be permitted. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Now, from VOA Learning English, it's time for Words and Their Stories. On this program, you can learn English expressions that Americans use in conversation. Today, we are going to talk about the fabric we wear on our bodies. In other words, our clothes, right? Well, yes and no. The word clothes is only part of a much larger story. American English has many more specific and more colorful terms related to these everyday items. For example, let's say you carefully select the clothes you plan on wearing to work or a party. Sure, those are your clothes, but it would be better to call it an outfit. The word outfit means there was some planning involved. In fact, when we compliment people on what they are wearing, we usually say, "Hey, I really like your outfit." We probably would not say, "Hey, I really like your clothes." It just sounds a little odd. Our wardrobe also has a sense of planning. A wardrobe is a collection of clothing. It is all the clothing a person owns. If I know a man or a woman who always looks sharp, I could say, "That person has an amazing wardrobe. Every item of clothing is gorgeous and fits perfectly." Now, even the nicest outfit in the nicest wardrobe collects dirt and wrinkles. Then that outfit becomes dirty clothes. But why use that ordinary term when you can call it laundry? Laundry, very simply, is any fabric, clothes, linens, towels, sheets, and blankets that we need to wash. Some people have a laundry room, an area in their house or apartment with a washer and dryer. People who don't have a washer and dryer in their homes can go to the laundromat. Now, if you're like me, doing your laundry can be one item on your laundry list of things to do on the weekend. Often, my Saturday morning begins with a couple loads of laundry. and I don't mind. It relaxes me to do laundry. Now, a laundry list is not a list of the things you need to wash. It is a very long list of related things. For example, if you have many small tasks to finish at work, you can say you have a laundry list of projects. Here's another example. At the parent-teacher meeting, the principal gave a terrible speech. It was just a laundry list of what the school staff had not done right. Whether you do your laundry at home, at a laundromat, or have a professional do it for you, we all have dirty laundry, in more ways than one. In conversation, dirty laundry is much more than soiled shirts and jeans. The expression dirty laundry means all those embarrassing things we don't want others to know about us or our families. We often use this expression as a warning. For example, if your mother catches you telling your friend something about your family, she may say, "Don't air our dirty laundry. Nobody needs to know every sordid detail about our family." Now, let's hear these expressions used in a conversation. These two friends are roommates in a medium-sized apartment building. It's Sunday morning, and they are doing their laundry.
Kendra, that is such a cute outfit you're wearing.
Thanks, Karen. I just updated my wardrobe and got rid of everything that didn't fit or just didn't look good on me.
I need to do that. Most of my clothes are too small. Oh, Kendra, I forgot to tell you something that happened yesterday.
What happened?
You know Raphael and Maya, right?
You're kidding, right? Of course I know them. They're the loud couple who live upstairs from us and fight all the time.
That's them. Well, yesterday they had a huge fight in the basement laundry room.
Right here in the basement laundry room?
Oh, yeah. And it was Saturday morning, so half the apartment building was down here doing their laundry.
What did they fight about?
Well, Maya found a woman's shirt in their laundry that was not hers. So she accused Raphael of cheating on her. He, of course, denied it. But then she gave him a laundry list of women he's been secretly seeing.
Well, not so secretly, if Maya knew about them.
Good point.
That sounds so embarrassing. It's not good to air your dirty laundry in public like that. They should have had their fight in the privacy of their own apartment.
I totally agree. That way, only you and I would have heard it.
Exactly. Can you hand me the laundry powder? And that's it for Words and Their Stories, a show where we teach common expressions in American English and where we don't air any dirty laundry. I'm Ana Mateo.
Today on our national parks journey, we head to the far western part of Texas. The landscape here is severe. The Chisos Mountains rise from the desert. The Rio Grande River cuts deep into ancient limestone rock. Cactus plants flower under the intense sun. Welcome to Big Bend National Park. At first sight, Big Bend seems empty of life, but The park is home to many plants and animals. Over 450 kinds of birds can be found within the park, along with 75 mammal species and more than 50 kinds of reptiles. The park's diversity comes from its three different ecosystems. Within the park are mountain, desert, and river environments.
The Rio Grande sustains the park. The river starts high up in the Rocky Mountains. Melting mountain snow is its main source. It travels more than 3,000 kilometers on its way to the Gulf of Mexico. The river cuts through the dry Chihuahuan Desert. Big Bend National Park contains the northernmost part of this desert. It is the second largest desert in North America. Much of the desert is south of the border in Mexico. The Rio Grande serves as an international border between the United States and Mexico for about 1,600 kilometers. The park itself shares a border with Mexico for 189 kilometers. The Chihuahuan Desert is the largest ecosystem in the park. 80% of the park is desert. Animals like jackrabbits, roadrunner birds, and mule deer live in the Chihuahuan. Many cactus and yucca species thrive. These are succulent plants. Most succulents have thick, heavy leaves that store water. Cacti store water in their stems.
High up in the park's Chisos Mountains, you will find fir and pine trees, aspens and maples. Temperatures here are much cooler than down on the desert floor. The entire Chisos Mountain range exists within Big Bend. It is the only mountain range in the United States that is fully within a national park. Its highest mountains, Emery Peak and Lost Mine Peak, each rise more than 2,000 meters above the hot desert floor. The woodland environment in the mountains is home to black bears, mountain lions, and gray foxes. It is also home to many kinds of birds. Visitors are drawn to the park because of its rare and unique bird species. One of these is the Colima warbler. These small gray, yellow, and red birds arrive at Big Bend in the springtime to mate and nest. Then they return south to Mexico. In the late summer, mountain sage flowers appear. Hummingbirds, blue-throated, ruby-throated, magnificent, and Lucifer seek out these flowers.
Along with its plant and animal life, the park is also rich in cultural history. Archaeological records of humans in the area go back about 10,000 years, beginning with the prehistoric Paleo-Indians. Later on, the Chisos Indians lived here, as did the Comanche and Jumano people and other native groups. Spanish explorers began to arrive in the area in the 1500s. They were searching for gold and fertile land. They described this land as despoblado, or uninhabited. Much of what is now Big Bend National Park was Mexican territory until 1848. Mexican settlers farmed and raised animals here. In the early 1900s, many Anglo-Americans began settling in the area.
Big Bend became a national park on June 12, 1944. It covers more than 320,000 hectares. President Franklin D. Roosevelt established the park just 1 week after D-Day. That is the day American and British troops invaded Normandy, France. As America's attention centered on World War II, Roosevelt established a new national park for future generations to enjoy. For several years before the park was created, hundreds of men worked to build roads and trails to prepare the area for visitors. They built the 11-kilometer road that leads to the Chisos Mountains Basin. A basin is a large area of the Earth's surface that is lower than the area surrounding it. Today, the basin is a popular place within the park. Visitors can stay in the Chisos Mountain Lodge there or at campgrounds. Many of the park's hiking trails begin near the basin. One of the most popular is the Lost Mine Trail. It starts near the Chisos Mountain Lodge. The trail goes up sharply through forests of pine, juniper, and oak trees. The 8-kilometer-long hike passes by lookout points for viewing Casa Grande Peak, one of Texas's major mountains. Hikers can also enjoy a view into the park's Juniper Canyon.
More than 300,000 people visit Big Bend each year. Most come between November and April, when the weather is cooler. A favorite way to explore the park is by boat on the Rio Grande. Many tour operators organize rafting trips. Rafting trips take you through many kilometers of beautiful deep canyons. They may last half a day or several days. On longer trips, travelers sleep next to the river in tents. Another way to enjoy the Rio Grande is in its many hot springs. These are places where hot water flows up from underground. The water temperature is over 40 degrees Celsius. The river's hot springs are said to have healing properties. They hold mineral salts from the earth. Big Bend National Park has offered beauty, excitement, and recreational challenge to visitors for more than 80 years. It is a true treasure of Texas and the larger United States. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.